comments and views expressed on The More Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Moore, The More Show, or this radio station and its affiliates or sponsors.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The More Show, which is sponsored by the UFO Matrix magazine. On today's show, I'm about to be joined by my guest, Lucy Wyatt. Now, Lucy and family live on an unspoilt farm by the east coast of England, and along with her family has restored the farm by using mostly eco materials. She grew up in the university town of Cambridge, where her father was an architect. Her book, Approaching Chaos, challenges our accepted view of progress since the end of the Ice Age by looking again at the origins of farmings and cities and focusing on Bronze Age civilization. As well as researching the ancient past, Lucy is also interested in earth energies. Lucy Wyatt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be with you.
Now, Lucy, just tell the audience a bit about yourself first.
Well, I live in Suffolk on a farm, which I did up as an eco project because it was derelict when we got here. I have two daughters that are fairly grown up now, and it took me about 10 years to write my book, which I did out of from an interest in alternative medicine, in homeopathy in particular. I wanted to go back to the origins and find out why people regard it as unscientific. And as I was digging around, I came across a bigger story, and that's really what my book grew out of.
Absolutely. So just tell us a bit about the book briefly.
Well, the book is really a massive overview. It goes back to the end of the Ice Age and gives an alternative interpretation as to why living in cities came about. Because I think we've told ourselves the wrong story. I think we've told ourselves a story that cities came out of a farming experiment, that Neolithic man was casting seeds about, had a surplus, got clever, decided to exchange it, markets grew, and towns and cities came from that. But when you look at the evidence, that's not actually what it shows. And so I challenge that. I use perfectly established, accepted material. I don't go looking for stuff that isn't already in the public domain. But I think the interpretations have been wrong, and I think we've misled ourselves. And as a result, we haven't come to the more interesting story, which is the one, I think, where these changes, the massive changes that happen because of certain elites, and cities grew out of something else and not out of farming. So, and then I look at what happened to it through the ages, you know, and bring it right up to the modern age. So it's a massive overview.
So how do you think that these big cities came about for their time?
Well, I think that there were certain groups of people who are a different kind of people. We have some possible physical evidence of who they were. If they are the people who had these elongated skulls, that's certainly one piece of possible evidence. And I think that they knew certain things. They knew how to access stuff. In particular, they used shamanic ritual, I think, in order to know what they knew, in order to access scientific knowledge, instant knowledge. They didn't develop their knowledge in an experimental way. It was instant. Because these cities, when they do start to grow, they grow as planned layouts. They are not random. That's the interesting part about them. And they date from about 5,000 BC onwards. And so I think that we really ought to reconsider our own views about certain elites.
So do you think we assume too much that, cities, grew out of marketplaces, basically?
Yes, I do. I think we take it all so much for granted. I think that we don't appreciate that there were major changes. The two key changes that I look at are first of all, when cereals became domesticated, which is at about 9,500 BC, thereabouts, quite near the end of the Ice Age. And the difference between a wild cereal and a domesticated one is the difference of a single gene, and it's to do with convenience, not taste. I can explain what that is. And the other key time frame that I look at is what the archaeologists call the secondary products revolution, and that's when animals became changed. That's when they became domesticated, and that occurs at about 5,000 BC. These are two massive alterations, And the conventional story is that because of the changes in agriculture, cities could then develop. And I say it's the other way around. I say that these changes happened because of cities. It's the city dwellers, the elites who knew how to deliberately interfere, particularly with the animals. That change is very, very significant. The secondary products revolution basically refers to a time when we could make an auroch or a cow docile enough to take the milk to make the secondary products of butter and cheese. That's what it refers to. And in the case of sheep, for example, we could use their coats to make wool, because before that, sheep had coats like deer. They didn't even have sheep coats that were usable. So even though Neolithic man had been penning these animals up for thousands of years for meat and hides, he still wasn't able to tame them sufficiently to be able to use these secondary products. So that's the really key difference that occurs at the time of cities.
So you were talking about perhaps modification techniques here to change the baseline of the animal. Is that what you're saying?
Definitely. And if you look at the work of a highly respected prehistorian like Steve Mithen, who's written a very good book called After the Ice, you can buy it at the Natural History Museum, he talks about the fact that when the domesticated variants arise, these animals change in shape and size. I mean, it's not just that they suddenly are tamed wild ones that can do this. They actually change physically. And for me, it's not just the physical change that matters. It's something that, for me, the important thing, something that happens in their heads, the fact that they become docile. I mean, as I said to you in the introduction, I live on a farm, and we have had here animals that can kill you easily, bulls and big horses and all sorts. And I know that these animals are only able to be on a farm because they're handleable, because they're docile. And people have overlooked that very significant importance.
So, okay then, where do you think the teachings of agriculture come from then?
Well, I think that they were part of this whole shamanic thing. I think that my point about cities is that they were a total package, and they were a package in terms of domestication of animals, the whole change in farming that happens, and also you have different things that happen with cereals to do with irrigation and ditching and terracing and that kind of very organized structural arable production. So you get this massive change in agriculture. You get all the big infrastructure, the use of water and aqueducts and viaducts and that kind of thing, the monumental architecture, all the domestic sort of drainage and sewage and everything that goes to do with that kind of infrastructure. You get the total package, and it's sort of education, medicine, cooking changes, because it becomes no longer nuts and berries and things from hedgerows, as it were. It becomes spices and cuisine, and substances are brought in from huge distances to make up a proper, and also on a bigger scale, bakeries and breweries, that kind of thing. So it's a total package that you get with civilization, and I think that this is something, it's an archetype that I describe that I think is always there, that people have known how to tap into. And that's why you have the same characteristics applying in different continents, even at different timescales, in Central and Southern America, as well as in Egypt and the Near East, and possibly China.
So are you saying then, Lucy, that these jumps are too sudden? And also, when did these jumps happen in your research? Were they after some sort of big climatic change in the Earth, or
not necessarily? Because I did look at that, because obviously I don't talk about Atlantis, because I only talk about what's in the public domain in terms of what's published material and accepted material. Because of that in itself, if you just go by that, there's enough of an interesting story to say. And I did wonder about Atlantis and the whole catastrophe idea. And there's no doubt about it that there are global catastrophes that do have an impact on all of this. And there's particularly one at the end of the 4th millennium BC, which is very significant. But my evidence shows that these changes, this package of civilization, had already arrived by that point. It was already apparent in Mesopotamia in southern Iraq. Before that point, those early cities of Uruk and Ur and Eridur and Shubruk, they were already there. And you can already see the traces of this whole thing. So I don't think that it's in response to some kind of environmental change that these things occur. I couldn't actually say for definite why these people were doing what they were doing. And also the earlier evidence to do with the domestication of cereals, the fact that it happens in the mountains. It's very obvious that people haven't realised that so often civilization appears to start in mountains. I mean, why would you start civilization in mountains? You'd only be in a mountain because you wanted things out of a mountain, its minerals and that kind of thing. And so obviously, whoever it was who knew these techniques, they were poking around a lot earlier. But where their actual bases were, where those even earlier cities were, I couldn't even begin to speculate.
But we're told, though, aren't we, that you know, people were savages, you know, living in caves, and you know, evolution is just a very slow process, and there's no sudden jumps as such. But you're saying your researchers took you in a completely different direction to say, you know, this just seemed to appear.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's Jericho that's the city that's often quoted as a place where massive changes seem to happen within the space of about 100 years. Because it's one of the longest continually inhabited cities in the world, but yes, definitely these aren't evolutionary changes. That's the point. And also, you see, what's also overlooked is that if you take a site like Çatalhöyük in Anatolia in Turkey, which is near Göbekli Tepe, which is another very even older site. I don't want to talk about Göbekli Tepe because it's sort of, I think, has a different kind of function. But Çatalhöyük, there's certain sort of anomalies there that don't make sense. There's certain sophistications in Çatalhöyük which don't seem to have can be explained by evolution, and yet it's still quite backward in other ways. I mean, the way I look at it is it's like saying, well, if you were a future historian and you went to Soweto and you found out that they were watching television, you might assume that they were living in a shanty town and had invented television. Possession is not proof of evidence of invention. So the fact that someone like Çatalhöyük in Turkey can have curious anomalies, to my mind, shows that there were elites who used indigenous populations to do certain things, who worked with the indigenous populations, and which is why the story is somewhat confused and a bit mixed up.
So do you think then that these ancient civilizations, where your researchers took you, shall I say, do you think they knew how key it was for a city to be there? I mean, obviously a city is a very key aspect, isn't it, of modern day living?
I think perhaps, I don't say this in the book, but I think perhaps what it is that these elites liked to live in cities. That's how they liked to live. They saw that as civilized, if you see what I mean. And so because what the research shows is that there was no real benefit to hunter-gatherers to actually move to cities. For example, research into the health of hunter-gatherers, what they do is they look at things like the state of their teeth and things like that. And it shows that their diets were actually better if they didn't live in cities. That the hunter-gatherer life wasn't necessarily that hard. I mean, we've kind of become very wrapped up in an idea that civilized farming is better, that life in cities is better, that hunter-gathering is somehow hard work. But I think all the evidence from around the world, even of modern hunter-gatherer societies that still exist, shows that that's not necessarily the case. So to my way of thinking, they were actually a different kind of people who brought about these changes in cities. These were not hunter-gatherers who thought it was an improved idea. Another factor which I think reinforces this point is that you would assume that in terms of these changes in farming, that they would go from nomadic hunter-gatherer to pastoralist. I mean by that someone who herds sheep and cattle over long distances, because that you can see a relationship between following herds to kill them and following herds to herd them. But actually, what the record shows is that every time there's a change in farming, in the introduction of Bronze Age farming, there's what they call a settled pattern first. And a settled pattern means the presence of pigs, because pigs aren't herded over long distances. And so what this, to my mind, shows is that these were a different kind of people with a different set of knowledge, a different set of skills, who moved into an area. And I had the opportunity to actually verify this, because one of the key places where these huge, great, big pastoral movements take place is in Central Asia, in the Fergana Valley, where the Kyrgyz tribes move their flocks up to the hills and mountains in the summer and down in the winter. And even there, in Bronze Age culture, and I went to the museum in Tashkent to look at this, to confirm this, even there, it was the settled pattern of pigs first that happened when the changes in farming occurred. And then the thing with sheep and cattle comes later. So that in itself is another strange thing that doesn't make any sense.
But surely being civilized and building cities is the next step for any civilization, you know, for convenience.
Well, not necessarily, because it's for whose convenience. That's the other point to bear in mind. Hunter-gatherer societies live very, very happily, and what you can see in the prehistoric record is that they don't change for thousands of years. They're perfectly content. They do a sort of basic kind of farming. You know, they scatter a few wild seeds. The Natufians, who were around from 12,000 BCE onwards, cultivated wild seeds for 3,000 years with their no change to the domesticated version. And they penned up their wild animals. You know, they followed the flocks, they followed the wild herds. They had their basic tools for survival. They were perfectly content. They had no real pressure on them to make this massive change. And the other key point that makes one suspicious is what the archaeological record shows is that the first people who start cities are not farmers, they're priests. The first sign of a city is some kind of shrine. That's what they've uncovered in Mesopotamia and southern Iraq. It is some kind of religious, sacred area. And it's the priests who are the beginning, the foundations of these cities. So I think they were a different sort of people who liked to live in a certain kind of way.
And why is that important, though, Lucy, for that aspect? Why is it important for the church to be the first ones in, then, to form a city?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call them church, but because they're the ones with the knowledge. They're the ones who know how to do the shamanic ritual. They're the ones who know how to access the information. They are the nerve center, the hub of the whole thing, and they're involved in every aspect of a city. They're the ones who supervise the buildings of the surveying and setting out the great buildings. They're the ones who sanction the trading exchanges. They're the ones who know about the food. They're the ones who interpret the weather, so that the calendar, they set the calendar so that farmers know when to sow and when to reap. They're the ones who can educate. They're the ones who heal the sick. They are absolutely at the centre of these ancient cultures.
So what do you think the ancients knew in the forms of, knowledge and technology as such?
Well, I think that the evidence in front of us that nobody satisfactorily explained is how they moved the big stones. I mean, that in itself is a kind of technology which so far we haven't been able to uncover. To move something that weighs 50 tons, 500 miles, is a feat that we would struggle with today with all our technology. And I don't buy the thousands of slaves argument, the hemp rope, the copper tools. That doesn't stack up. And these feats were able to be achieved not just in Egypt. I'm talking about the moving of the granite from the Aswan quarry up to Giza, 500 miles. But you see the same characteristic feats in Central and Southern America with massive blocks moved and so forth. So I think that in itself shows that they knew something that we don't.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say they didn't necessarily leave short, miserable lives of ill health either. I think Ramesses II, I think, is believed to have lived at least until his 80s.
So why would our advanced culture, sort of dismiss what the ancients knew, though?
Why would our culture dismiss what the ancients knew? Because we've had this massive break in between us, there's this huge wall, this huge barrier, which caused the collapse of those societies and has prevented us from fully understanding them. And that's the whole rise in power, particularly of the Romans. But all the Indo-European tribes have some sort of role to play in bringing about the demise of the Egyptians. The Greeks were very close to the Egyptians, but even so, they didn't know all their secrets. And the Egyptians, I don't think, fully trusted them. And they really did not want their secrets to fall into the hands of the Romans. And then you see the problem is that the Romans then got mixed up with that monotheistic religion we call Christianity. And we've been in the Dark Ages ever since, because their whole thing was about destruction of knowledge. And one of the interesting things that I found in my research was that we've also told ourselves the story that the Romans just persecuted Christians. But actually, what's completely fascinating is that long before they started persecuting Christians, they were already out destroying people with ancient knowledge. They were against alchemists, the Pythagoreans. Lots of the military campaigns that they fought, I think, were motivated by a desire to destroy. I mean, what were they doing in the Commagene, for example? Why did Mark Antony fight a campaign there in AD 70, if it wasn't because that was the last bastion of the Babylonian Magi, the Chaldean Magi, when it's a central part of Turkey? The Romans had no real reason to be up there. It wasn't of any strategic value. And there's plenty of people who think that their reason for coming to Britain was in order to destroy the Druids, because one of their early campaigns was Mona and on the island of Anglesey. So that in itself is kind of curious.
Absolutely. So you do believe that through your research, that ancient wisdom, ancient knowledge of how these, you know, how we went from agriculture to these advanced cities that were there at the time, has all been lost through control and the destruction of ancient knowledge by the Roman Empire, for example.
Yes, and then that's continued by the Catholic Church. You know, we lost the knowledge of something as basic as geometry for a long time. It's only really, as I understand it, through Knights Templars and the Gothic cathedral movement that in itself came back to the West. It's been a huge force of darkness in terms of ignorance, that whole Romano-Christian thing.
But it's very difficult to sort of, you know, connect the dots in a logical way when there are no records.
It's not easy. I mean, it does mean you have to be like a forensic detective and look at bits of evidence and try and corroborate stuff. That's certainly true. And you have to kind of try and put it together in such a way that you reconstruct it. And bits of knowledge, I think, have got stuck in different places around the world. So you do need to have a fairly big overview in order to try and piece it all together again. I mean, that's really what I was trying to do with the book, to do that.
And Lucy, in your opinion, why the big monuments then?
I think they built big monuments because they could, because they had the technology to do that. Because they also, I think, had a very kind of cosmic way of looking at stuff. It depends what you think the purpose of the big monuments were. I mean, if it's something like the Great Pyramids, I think they were probably multifunctional. Probably, say, take the pyramids in Egypt and elsewhere, obviously. Their purpose is to form some kind of anchoring of earth energies. I do think they have a geodesy function to them. But also they were very important in terms of ritual, particularly the pharaoh's shamanic ritual, which we haven't really understood, because we think that anything that talks about the pharaoh's soul is to do with him being dead, whereas actually it's as likely he was undergoing a shamanic ritual in life, and which involved astral planing with his soul, and that was possibly another of the functions of the pyramids. So they had a sort of energy function. As I understand it, the word, Egyptian word for pyramid is mur, which means instrument to ascend. So they had sort of different roles.
And have you been to the pyramids?
I have. I've been to the Egyptian pyramids. I've been inside the King's Chamber, which is quite an experience.
And could you feel a sort of energy there, or?
Well, all I can say is that when I got to the bottom of the Grand Gallery before I climbed up to the King's Chamber itself, I did have a massive panic attack because it's quite claustrophobic in there in some ways. I mean, there's enough space, but it gets hotter and hotter. There's less and less air as you go up. It's not really a place to hang about for too long. So I can well believe that in the right circumstances, these places were turned into some kind of instrument, without a doubt. But they weren't tombs. I don't believe they were tombs.
Okay. So would you say then, as we've sort of touched on before, that after some sort of global catastrophe, you know, that's when Egypt, you know, sort of rised, basically?
Yeah. Well, I think what happened in at the end of the fourth millennium BC is I think possibly a comet hit the world, and there was a massive wobble, because I think it's after that point that you get this phenomenon in different quarters of the world with submerged forest, very suddenly submerged forest, and raised beaches. There's an equal and opposite effect happens. And it's after this date that you have massive migrations of all peoples. They all go in search of safer homelands. It's then that the Indo-Europeans split up. Because what I've worked out is where the Indo-Europeans originated from was the Ukraine, north of the Black Sea. And some go west and some go east and some go round and south down through the Caucasus and into Turkey and all east through Iran. So they spread out in all different ways. But it's also at that point that I think the Mesopotamians also moved, and because after that point that you see the Indus Valley civilization arises, the Egyptian dynastic Egypt appears. So it's possible that they were returning to Egypt. It's possible that they were actually repairing the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. Robert Schock, Dr. Robert Schock, the geologist, the Boston geologist, who has dated the Sphinx to 6,000-7,000 BC or whenever, because that's the time when the Sphinx would have been exposed to rainfall, because there was no rainfall much after the end of the fourth millennium BC. So it's quite possible that they were returning to these places and repairing what was already there. I wouldn't deny that.
And like we've said before, it's just incredible how they moved and cut the stone then, isn't it?
Well, exactly. They definitely knew how to do something extraordinary with that. And their amazing ability to sculpture and to carve. I mean, if you go to the British Museum, you can just be blown away by the technical ability out of extremely hard stone, diorite and basalt and granite, and how they can make these bowls with these tiny, these sort of jugs with tiny necks, these vases with tiny necks. It's all so precision made. And I just don't believe that they were able to do that by bashing things with another hard stone. That just doesn't make any sense. These exquisite detailed carvings in stone and etchings and so forth. I mean, it takes your breath away. And I just don't think we appreciate them enough.
Absolutely. And, you know, do you buy the idea that the Egyptians were a sort of slave society as such?
Well, anyone has to be very careful, you see, because part of the problem that we have is, as I said to you earlier, Greeks and Romans are like a barrier. They're a barrier between us and the ancient past. And so much of what we understand about Egypt comes through the Greeks. And so the Greeks didn't necessarily know everything, and they an awful lot of what you see in Egypt today is actually Greek. It's Ptolemaic. It dates from the time when the Greeks became pharaohs. So it's not actually a true representation of what was truly Egyptian. And if we take someone like Herodotus, who wasn't alive at the time of the earlier Egyptian stuff, who was aware of slave societies, the Greek and Roman slave societies, it's very easy to be misled by them imposing their views on that ancient past. And things like the excavation of the pyramid workers' villages around the Great Pyramid in Giza shows that they were not slaves. They were free people. They came and went. They were seasonal workers. They were benefited from medical attention, good quality medical attention. They had the best cuts of meat. They had the same kind of living standards as aristocrats in Egypt. So I think we have to be very careful when we talk about slaves, what exactly we mean by that.
So would you say then that, as you've mentioned before, that you believe the Roman Empire was, you know, the epiphany for the destruction of the knowledge, perhaps, of the Egyptians? Do you think that was a kind of fall of, you know, human spiritual consciousness when that happened? Because obviously, like you say, we entered a very dark time just after this.
Yes, quite possibly. I mean, my thinking is that the Indo-Europeans, they may in themselves have been some kind of modified race. I don't say this in the book, but they may have been. They may have been people that were recruited to work in cities. And then a little bit like sort of Sorcerer's Apprentice, they then ran amok. So that they weren't particularly evolved themselves. And the civilizers had no real means of controlling them in the end and just withdrew. And so allowed laws of karma and reincarnation to take over until such time that these Indo-Europeans learnt their lessons. And I think that time is possibly coming now. I think we're now in the fruition of that great long time. Because it's interesting, isn't it, that the 4th millennium BC catastrophe time, the 3159 BC, is around the time that the Mayan long calendar starts. So isn't it interesting that we're now coming to the fruition of that whole 5,000 time period? And we've had lots of opportunities to learn our lessons during that time.
But we say, I mean, well, I've said to you, and you've sort of answered it as well, that, you know, the ancient information you believe was lost. Other scholars have had access to ancient knowledge, we believe, don't they? I mean, I've read before that perhaps Sir Isaac Newton had access to ancient texts.
Yes. I mean, when you say it's lost, it's not totally lost. If you know the techniques for accessing it, it's not lost. I mean, one of the things that people fail to realise is that Isaac Newton was a very important alchemist, and a vast proportion of his library was on alchemy. And one of the things I haven't explained to you is what I think the true meaning of alchemy is, because I think alchemy was very much part of that whole shamanic ritual, the thing that the pharaohs and the other elites, the other priestly elites, knew how what to do. Because I think that the true meaning of alchemy is to do with astral planing. I think the word itself, I think, means the Egyptian word, the fixed stars, the chemi. And I think that that's what the pharaohs were doing in the pyramids. There's a very important festival that the pharaohs took part in called the Hebsed Festival, which happened every 40 years. And during this festival, public aspects and private aspects, secret aspects. And in the secret aspects, the pharaoh, he would have consumed a substance which may have been something like the philosopher's stone, the solar bread it was called. And then he retreats inside the pyramid where he's ritually buried for 3 days. And it's at this point he's having the out-of-body experience, the astral planing. And he is travelling to the fixed stars, to the chemi. And how we know this is because it's written about in what they call the coffin text, the pyramid text, which we've always assumed to be about his journey as a soul after death. Because when people talk about soul, that's what we assume. But actually, it's as likely to be a shamanic journey in life. Now, it's more than likely that Isaac Newton knew about these techniques and he knew how to do that, and that's how he developed the knowledge that he did. It's quite possible. And he's not the only one, I'm sure.
Well, no, I mean, going back from him, I mean, they're obviously the Knights Templar. They seem to have a sort of very secret knowledge of the ancients as well.
Definitely. And that's one of the other things that completely fascinated me was why Bernard of Clairvaux, who was the man who wrote the ordinances, the religious ordinances for the Knights Templars, why he preached the Second Crusade at Vézelay, which involved them not going to Jerusalem, but going to a place called Edessa or San Liufa. Now, the key point about that is that that's in sort of Syria, kind of northern Euphrates area. The key part about that is that that particular place, and I think that that San Ulfa was the original Ur of the Chaldees, and I'm not the only person who's come to that conclusion, the Ur of Abraham, is because it was right next to a city called Haran, H-A-R-R-A-N, which is a very, very ancient city. And it's that city of Haran where when Egypt started to collapse, when the Romans really got stuck in there after 30 BC, that these groups of people called Sabians went up the trade routes and ended up at Haran, and they were alchemists. And I think that that's what Bernard of Clairvaux was after. He was after the Knights Templars, making contact with those people, definitely.
And
much of a coincidence,
yeah, you know, this all goes sort of towards the way we live now. I mean, do you, from what you're saying, you've talked about, you know, astral travel, which, again, just remind me and the audience, astral travel is when you leave your body and travel to what you would call the astral plane. Is that right? Which is the spiritual planes?
I mean, what happens now is there's plenty of people who know about these things now, that shaman who exist in Peru or Mongolia or wherever. And what they do, still do, is they'll take something like the ayahuasca vine, which puts them into a trance, and then at that point they can journey as a spirit form. And what they normally do today is they go looking for answers to, say, cure the sickness of a child or something like that. So these are wise people who've trained since childhood, probably, in order to be able to do this, because it is dangerous. I mean, it's not something that should be undertaken lightly. And and they know how to do that, to split off into their spirit form and go travelling in that spirit form to get these answers. The point about them is that that's just one way of doing it. What people haven't realised is that pharaohs and city rulers and city priests were the same, but they just used different techniques. But the principles are exactly the same. And you can see, there's a book by an Oxford academic called Dr. Jeremy Nadler called, I think it's called Shamanic Wisdom or something, or the Pyramid Text. And he's done an analysis which shows that the language of these coffin texts, and they're written on the inside of the walls of the pyramid at Saqqara, is the same kind of language that shaman used throughout the whole world. About climbing ladders, about flying up, and all this kind of thing. So I'm just saying that these people, in principle, were the same, but they just use a different substance, a different technique. And I personally think that alchemy comes into it, because one of the substances that the pharaohs used was a form of modified gold, which they may have mixed with other things in order to make their solar bread. And the philosopher's stone, the gold of the alchemist, could well be part of all that. And I think the Greeks observed some of this, but they didn't realise what the true purpose of it was. So we've got this rather muddled view of what alchemy actually is, thanks to the Greeks, because they weren't told all the secrets.
So do you think, then, that the ancients had a deep understanding of the emotional, spiritual and physical needs and of the body, which most, I suppose, modern-day doctors may not take into account?
Oh, absolutely. They had a concept of everything being connected, and that how we live is reflected in our different etheric bodies. They had an understanding of auras. All these sort of things that we're only now rediscovering as we sort of find out stuff from India, it's all part of the same system, the whole chakra system. It's all connected in. They understood about all these energetic aspects of the body and how you can heal it and how you can use it in different ways, without a doubt.
Sure. I mean, do you think our attitude makes a big difference in our healing as well, which is something which was sort of taken more into account in the ancient knowledge as well?
Possibly. I mean, the thing is that they would have had a very clear understanding that you need to try and live a good life. You need to try and live an ethical life. One of the key parts about their whole philosophy is shown in their Hall of Judgment scenes, where the soul is led before the 42 deities, the 42 Nitas, and the soul has to go through negative confessions, which is, I have not committed adultery, I have not polluted the Nile, I have not done this, I have not done that. And then the point about the Egyptian view is that the soul is weighed in the scales against the feather of Maat, the feather of truth. And this is the heart soul. This is an aspect of the body called the heart soul, called the Ab. And it's done in front of Osiris, who's sitting in judgment with a crook and a flail, a crossed crook and a flail. And the point is that if the soul is found to have told the truth and led a good life, then the soul joins the ancestors. But if the soul isn't and hasn't, then there's a hybrid hippo croc called Apit or Amit or something, who devours the soul, and the punishment is to be reincarnated to relearn your lessons. Now, what to me is completely fascinating is that the Christians took this iconography, they took these images, and you can still see it. I've got a medieval doom painting in the church in the village next door to me, where you still have the same weighing scales, exactly the same shape, and you have the cross keys of St. Peter because he's in judgment. But the hippo croc has been airbrushed out of the scene. There's no possibility of reincarnation. There, the punishment is deliberately heaven or hell. And that, to me, is a whole kind of mind control thing. They have no evidence for that. That was something that Origen, one of the early church fathers in the 2nd century AD, deliberately decided to introduce as a policy measure. I mean, how sick is that? And we've been suffering ever since without that knowledge.
Again, that comes down to the whole control aspect, doesn't it?
Totally, utterly. And that's what's so horrible, is that they got into our minds and they interfered with our minds and they interfered with our freedom, our free will and our ability to develop ourselves. And that's what's so horrible. And they thought it was okay to torture us for the good of our eternal souls, you know, the Inquisition, because they have this whole mentality that the end justifies the means. And we can still see that today, this whole mentality, the end justifies the means. You know, it's okay to commit some kind of atrocity. It's okay to destroy your environment for the sake of a new runway, because economic prosperity justifies all of that. And this same mentality is everywhere with us today still, which is very sad.
So what they knew, do you think that's the key to how we go forward now?
I think what they knew and how they thought is the key to how we go forward, because I think it's about philosophy. It's about understanding that everything is interconnected. How you do something is as important as why you do it. That's the really key one. And I think if more people took that on board and changed their own personal lives, then everything else would change. You know, it's the old Marxist thing, isn't it? Theory and praxis. You know, if you change the way of thinking, actions change. And that's a really important lesson for me of the ancients. They provide a role model in terms of a blueprint of how to live in harmony and in comfort with the earth. That's also very important. We can go back to that. We can relook at that. You know, it's not we don't have to go back to living in caves. There aren't enough caves for us to live in anyway. We have no choice but have some kind of urban model. And so they do provide an alternative, which I think is very inspirational and very positive. And also they did have this thing of understanding everything is interconnected. I mean, you take our treatment of domestic animals, for example. We treat them appallingly. We've abused the gifts that the civilizers gave us in terms of these domesticated beasts. We in the 19th century, for example, we were led to believe they didn't have souls, therefore they could be abused. Well, of course animals have souls. They've agreed to let us modify them. They've agreed to work with us. They've agreed to sacrifice themselves to provide us with protein. I'm not a vegetarian. To provide us with protein. But I still treat my animals with respect. I still acknowledge their needs and treat them in a different kind of way. And that's the bit that we've lost, and I think we should definitely reconnect with that. I think it's appalling what we do to animals.
Do you think that's the same for the earth as well? Because, I mean, if you look at big business mining or forestry, whatever it may be, the total destruction they cause, and they don't care about the land.
Completely ghastly. Utterly dreadful. And one of the things that I am beginning to feel very concerned about is this whole business of the war on terror, which many people believe is just a cover story, and nobody is looking at the environmental destruction of Afghanistan. One of the slides that I put up recently in a talk was of a map of the mineral resources in Afghanistan, $908 billion worth of iron and copper and all this kind of thing. And why should the American industrial military complex be allowed to destroy that country and its environment? It's completely sick. I mean, we all know about the Amazon forest and the destruction there, but nobody's talking about what must be going on in Afghanistan, which I think is just appalling. You know, I mean, not that I wish to promote the Taliban or anything, but if they really are safeguarding Afghanistan, then they should be allowed to do that. I think it's just horrible at the way they think. And it's all for what? So we can all sit in front of a plasma screen and look at virtual reality? Is that the objective? And eat junk food? No, thank you.
Well then, okay, Lucy, do you feel that a time of change is upon us right now with respect to, you know, Earth and other natural forces as well?
Yes, I do. I think there's huge times of change. I think that this climate change thing that's happening at the moment, there's no doubt about it, the seasons are very peculiar. I think that's making people wake up and realise. One of the things that I campaign on locally is to try and create awareness of a need for food security policies. And in England, in Britain in particular, we're incredibly vulnerable because we import so much of our food. I don't know if you realise, but in 2007, government statistics showed that we imported 97% of our fruit. 97%. That means we only produce 3% in this country. I mean, I've got all the statistics. They're completely shocking. So what's happened to dairy, you know, meat or vegetables or whatever it is. And people talk about the problems of Africa and so forth, and I'm not saying that they haven't got problems, but that would be as nothing compared with the problem that we'd have, because we wouldn't even know how to survive in a kind of basic subsistence sort of way that at least Africans know how to do that. We don't. You imagine if we had anything, any kind of catastrophe here. The one doom scenario that I talk about is the Carrington event, if you're familiar with the Carrington event.
Explain it for the audience, please.
Oh, it's quite a fascinating one. It's something that happened in 1859. There's a man called Carrington who observed this phenomenon. It's to do with coronal mass ejections of the sun, so aurora borealis. And in 1859, it was so massive that you could see by the light of the thing and down in the tropics. I mean, it was just huge. But then all it did in 1859 was take out a few telegraph lines. In 2008, the American Academies of Science published a report to say that if a coronal mass ejection occurred on the same scale today, that we could be without electricity for 4 to 10 years. I mean, can you imagine what kind of civilization would we in England have if that happened? Zero. I mean, it would be just horrific. Because we import all our food, we couldn't even feed ourselves. So that's why I think it's very important that people understand how vulnerable we are and that we mustn't take our so-called advanced civilization for granted. Because with one big blur from the sun, it could all vanish.
So how do we protect ourselves against that, though?
Well, I think that what we need to do is to acknowledge the need to have some kind of resilience, as many small producers of food as possible, and to try and curb the power of the big supermarkets in some way, to let local people understand these things. I campaign at a county level to try and get my local county councillors to understand the need for food policy. And it's not just the outlets, it's not just the retailers that's the problem, to let them understand that they must support food production infrastructure so that it's a good idea to encourage the construction of small local abattoirs, for example, to know where the seed merchants are, the machinery repairs people, the whole kind of thing that goes into food production. Because the problem that we have is that we have a business model that encourages us to create economies of scale all the time. And that means concentration in a very few places. Whereas what, for survival, what we need is fragmentation, is lots of small, local. And you can do it through different ways in terms of like reducing carbon footprint or whatever it is that you want to do. But it's really raising awareness to make everybody realize that it doesn't matter who it is that's producing the food, that we all need to have some part to play in it and not keep destroying our market towns so that their local producers have no outlet. That's what happens when the supermarkets take over, is that they remove that route to market. Not all of them, just those that have this highly centralized economy of scale approach. Every little helps to destroy your local economy, is the point.
So do you think then that we are at a tipping point with our civilization?
Yes, I think we probably are at a point, because I think that those, as you said earlier, the big corporations that want to take all the resources, destroy rivers and streams and mountains and forests and all the rest of it, and people are beginning to realise that actually they would like to live in good environments. They do care. I mean, look at what happened with the BP oil fiasco. Is all those people who lined up on the beaches. Those are now people who are thinking about it more deeply. And people are becoming more sensitive to all of this, without a doubt. And I think that even these protests that are happening at the moment, you know, the Occupy Wall Street or whatever it is, people are beginning to think, well, what is it for? Okay, so you've got all the money. What are you going to do with it? You know, there's that fantastic, is it Sioux Indian quotation, which is something like, only when man has destroyed the last tree, ruined, polluted the last river, eaten the last fish, will they realise that they cannot eat money. And that's we've got out of balance, and that's really the point that needs to be readdressed.
And you feel that there is light at the end of the tunnel?
Yes, I do think there's light at the end of the tunnel. I am optimistic about the future. I think things could get a lot worse, but I think that there are other, this is why I'm pointing my book, because there are other models of how to live, and I think that those ancients do provide some kind of blueprint, and if everything else did collapse, we could go back to looking at what the ancient system was, and I don't think that's such a bad thing. And I do think that the more people that become aware and change their own personal ways of living, the more hope there is, definitely.
And very briefly, I mean, what changes would you make now?
What changes would I make now? What, to my own personal life?
Yeah.
Well, I am working on trying to work out how to generate electricity in a more environmentally sensitive way. I have installed on the farm a biofuel processing plant, and so we run the tractor on processed oilseed rape, that we produce very high quality fuel for that, and I can use that in a generator to generate electricity. But I'm thinking about other things. I'm interested in these ideas of sort of the Tesla variety, the magnetic motors and that kind of thing, and I am working with some people on trying to make that happen. So I continually try to improve my own self-sufficiency and my own... we installed a water hand pump the other day for our 60-foot well. That was a big moment. So we can now pump water by hand. Extraordinary, low technology. We got really excited about it, because that's just a backup, because I'm on my own water supply here, and so if my electricity goes, my pumps fail, I have no water. But at least I now can boil a kettle or something.
Excellent. No,
so I continue to work on those projects.
Yes,
yeah.
It's nice to see someone embracing the advice they're trying to give as well, which I always like.
For example, I have this I have my own sewage system, because I'm not on mains for anything apart from electricity, but then I can be off mains for that as well. And we have a three pond system, which uses flow forms get a bit of more oxygen in it, and that's the bit that pumps, but otherwise it works on gravity. and reeds and gravel and water, and it meets Environment Agency standards, and it deals with all the waste from the house and all the domestic waste, all my sewage, and no smell. It's working with nature, no chemicals, and that to me sums it all up, you know, working with nature.
Absolutely.
And I have a perfectly civilized life. I'm not having to do, you know, you have perfectly normal, you know, baths and loos and all the rest of it. But I'm working with it, and I have a clear conscience, you know, I'm very happy about it. And I have a beautiful thing with reeds and flowers and moorhen living on it. And it works beautifully, and it has been for the last 8 or 9 years. So I'm very happy about that.
So where can people find your book from?
I am on Amazon. So if they Google me, and I have my own website, which is www.approachingchaos.co.uk, which I think has a link through to Amazon. So that's probably the best way to find it, and it's really just a massive history book. It'll give them lots of information, lots of detail, and sort of shows what happens, and to help put things in a different kind of perspective. Because I think, because it's not stuff we're taught in schools, it's quite hard to get your head around it sometimes, and so I'm really trying to open up your mind to look at things differently. And it's all positive. I don't talk about anything horrible.
Well, all I'll say is, Lucy White, thank you so much for joining us today.
Kevin, it's a thrill. Thank you.
To find out more information on Lucy, just go to my website, which is themoreshow.co.uk, and look up Lucy White under past guests. Now, don't forget that you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get the latest updates on the show. And then every Friday at 6 p.m, we have a TV show which goes out on Sky 201 and Freesat 403, so don't miss it. So until next time, thanks for listening.